It's a good parsha to occur right before Yom Kippur. There are some wonderful imagery in chapter 29 that even now, when Moses speaks to the Israelites, your heart is turning, and it has one of my favorite verses. I talked a while ago about the Torahitic code of morality, which is to do what is right in the eyes of God rather than to do what is right in one's own eyes. And this is where you get the phrase, I will be okay even though I follow my own willful heart. That's, I think, 29:18. So I think this week's parasha gives us a sense of Torahitic morality and also indicates some of the ways that we can do cheshbon ha-nefesh, reflection upon the soul, accounting of the soul in preparation for Yom Kippur. But it challenges us a little, I would say, about how to do that for oneself and how to help each other in the preparation. So there was a Hebrew phrase that Rafe and I picked up this week in Thursday's minyan. And it says that ki ata tavo, that you will come, I think this is when Moses is charging Joshua, to bring the people with you. And really the grammar would suggest ki ata tavi, which is used in a later verse, because it's tavo is you will come yourself, but tavi is you will bring, effectively. So it should have said you will bring. And then our sages note that too. It's interesting, our sages noted the same thing that Rafe and I picked up on, that the verb is a little bit anomalous there. So it's in 31, it says tavo, and about 20 verses later, it says tavi. You will come relative to you will bring. And some of our sages say it's tavo because you come and maybe you are not the one to do it, but you will bring them. And Rashi says, quoting the Talmud, noting the differences, you might have to bring them against their own will. There's a sense in that distinction that sometimes you have to challenge people. Sometimes you have to pull yourself along. Sometimes you have to pull other people along. Sometimes you have to push. Sometimes you have to go and take the lead. I wish I had it in front of me. I meant to grab it. My yad that I use for weekday minyanim is carved wood. It's done on a CNC machine by a friend of mine from LA who's now in Greenville, who carved it based on a principle that my rabbi taught us, which is there's two phrases in Exodus. One is about Miriam and one is about Moses. That says Ashiru ladonai ki ga'oga'a and Shiru ladonai ki ga'oga'a, and one is on each side of the yad. I meant to bring it as a prop. If someone wants to run to the chapel, I'll show it, but it's not necessary. So Shiru is carved with a pointing finger, and Ashira is done with a hand. Arnold, you were asking me about this, right? So what it is to say, in my rabbi's opinion, was that there are different models of leadership in the rabbinate, as in any other field. Shiru is you go, tavo, tavi, tavi. And ashira is I'm going to go, you come with me. That's sort of the challenge of the holiday season, is we need to help each other to grow. We need to help. I guess this is turning into less of a discussion than I expected. I meant to throw the question to you. So what do you think the difference is in your lives? You know, there's that different models based on the verbs that I described, ashira, shiru, the pointing versus the beckoning, tavo, I will go, you will go, tavi, you will bring. When you think about this season spiritually, does that have any resonance for you in the way that you relate to yourself or the way you relate to your fellow or your spouse or your children? In the ways in which we are guardians for each other in the process of tshuva? Anyone think about that process? Not all at once. Sorry. Peggy?
It never works very well to simply tell somebody, hey, go do that.
Yeah.
I mean, you better do it yourself first. You know, what's that old adage? Don't reach. I forget what it is, but no, it never works very well to just order somebody else to do something.
Yeah. It'd be nice if it did, though, wouldn't it? Wouldn't that be a great world? Miriam and Rachel? What?
You need both.
I think that's the point of the yacht. It's got both ends. Only one of them is really good for reading Torah, because if the other one's like this, and it's hard to figure out what you're doing. But I always point this the one way for Torah. But I do remind myself, yeah. Yeah, it's a ambivalence almost. Oh, I'm sorry, Rachel was next.
Most people my age, and indeed most Americans at this point, I'm on the internet too much. And the one thing Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and that's something to think about because that's data that is kind of training us to order, to boss people around, to wave our fingers at everyone instead of being a model in any way.
That's a great statement. I think that's part of what I was connecting with. And so you'll see some of this in a sermon I'm giving about narcissism in this political age. Yeah, I took a year and a half fast from Facebook and was advised by synagogue leadership that it would be helpful if I could have some sort of Facebook presence to promote us. But I think a part of it was that reason. I was spending more time spouting or listening to people spout than actually doing. There was a great article in The New Yorker about the Green Revolution in Iran and how it said that that was supported by Twitter, which is in this article was an overstatement, and the other point it made, maybe these were two separate articles, you couldn't have done the 60s civil rights movement by Twitter, because what Twitter allows you to do is have a lot of casual contact to social action and social justice, but real progressive movements often require deep involvement of 20 and 50 hours and weeks of your life. You know, my dad went down to Montgomery for 2 weeks. It wasn't something he could do on Twitter or send a postcard, you know, to Montgomery and to March. You wanted to speak?
Yeah, I was thinking that the one side of the yacht is kind of a leadership by demand, by pushing, and the other is by example. And we really, as Rachel said, need both.
Yeah.
It's a really important balance.
Yeah. I found this in my own work, and I saw my rabbi do it. When people die, one of the wonderful things about Jewish grief practices is that you are stricken with the death of a loved one, you have no idea what the next step is. And there are definitely times in human experience where you just need an arrow. You know, he would just say, here's what we're doing next. I've done it. Here's what we're doing next. People need to hear what's coming next. They're not sheep. They're not afraid. It's just the choices are overwhelming and you need to narrow it for them. That's part of a work. Let me give you another example that I think is interesting that's on the same vein, and then I'll try to tie that to a third thing, which I still have not made the clear connection in my head, but I know it's there. So we get these, this is our only cliffhanger. Actually, there's another one. This is a cliffhanger, this parsha. I always think of it as a cliffhanger because it said, the very last line that Marianne read is, you know, you're sing this song, colon, like the, here comes the song, and then the song is next week. Sometimes this parsha is read with Nitzavim, but it's never read with Ha'azinu, and that's, Miriam said, oh, I thought I was reading Ha'azinu this week, and well, one could think that because a lot of this parsha is talking about next week's parsha. Says, get ready to sing this song. Moses writes down the poem, you write down a Sefer Torah, you use the poem as a witness. So I would think, to me it's always been obvious what it's referring to. It's referring to the next week's parasha. Interestingly, it's not so clear to our sages what it was referring to. I thought it was pretty obvious. So Rashi agrees with me that the poem it's referring to and the poem it keeps telling you you're going to sing is just Parshat Ha'azinu, and it's the limited portion that's written in, as Jeff noted, columns. It's written in special poetic script or poetic orthography. But Rashbam, who was Rashi's grandson, says, and to background to this, a lot of the books of Torah have nicknames. Like Leviticus is called Torat Kohanim, the Torah of priests, and Deuteronomy is called Mishneh Torah, which is where Maimonides gets the name of his book, his multi-volume work, magnum opus. And Mishneh Torah means the repetition of Torah, which is basically what Deuteronomy means in Greek. So Rashbam says that Hashira, the song that Moses keeps referring to, is all of Deuteronomy. And Ha'azinu is really just a section of rebuke to remind you, watch your step. So I think this ties into my questions and my thought process about the work of tshuva, both internally and as we work in community. How much do you say to other people? How much can you bite off at once? You know, sometimes you get a lot of valuable information and you swim in it. And sometimes someone will say something to you. I said something to a colleague of mine that I had heard. Sometimes just a little slogan is enough. I said to her, a colleague, you know, you have to preach from your scars, not your wounds. And she thought, like, oh, that's just a short 5 words or however many words that was that can transform your work. And we've all had that, you know. Someone tells you, I mean, I was looking at Ted, so I'm thinking of physics equations, but a physics equation doesn't have the same power to transform your work. You know, it's just a helpful mental rubric and shortcut. What's so funny? It does? You disagree? It does. It does. I don't think it'll help. I don't think it's going to help, Carol. But, right. So it's actually, I wasn't sure. I guess it is actually the same idea. A slogan and an equation, it is a paradigm, you know, and can give you a new paradigm to put in your head. So that's the question, you know, how much information can you assimilate at one time? What's your goal for Yom Kippur? Are you going to try to radically change or just work on the low-hanging fruit? You know, and I think both are valuable efforts. I'm a big fan, as I've said and reiterated, of marginal change. In economics, you know, what's the least you can do for the greatest effect? I think that's a great way to view your life. You know, for me, that time about a year and a half ago was stopping Facebook. I could see where my life, you know, I needed another 10 hours a week and I stopped using Facebook. So that's the question. You know, what's the simplest change one could make in one's life? Maybe it's cutting out caffeine that will really affect you. Sleeping, going to sleep a half hour earlier, waking up a half hour earlier, whatever it might be. Or do you want to try to look at yourself more Catholically, more broadly, and evaluate and think about all of it? You know, I think that's the difference between this song as a small pericope, as a small section, a parasha, or this song as the broader corpus of Jewish law. Thoughts as you prepare yourself for Yom Kippur? Not all at once. No, not at once. Sorry, I overused that. It was my calculus teacher's line. I loved it. It's whenever no one would raise their hand, he would always say that to us.
So, it's very hard sometimes to know when you're trying to take the Heshbon HaNefesh, what you really need to do for you.
Yeah.
Sometimes what I most want is some clarity about what the heck should I be focusing on and how should I be focusing.
That's good. That's good. I think that's like the metaphor I gave or the image I gave of people in grief. There's just so many choices. We can become paralyzed by choice. I think that's definitely an insight of Judaism, is that one could be paralyzed by choice. It's nice, you know, I have another professor, a rabbi once said, he had trouble going to kosher restaurants because then he could eat anything on the menu. You know, and it's like, what do? I usually can only eat three things. It's much easier to decide. So I think that's an insight of Judaism around grief, around food, around morning, you know, what to do when you wake up in the morning, around what you're allowed to say, is that it's a bewildering choice. And in this day and age, I think I've cited this before, they did a study trying to sell people jam. And if you present people with 12 or 24 options of jam, they taste a few and walk away. If you present them with 3 or 6 options of jam, they'll buy. Too many options, you just walk away and don't do anything. So that's a danger inherent in too much choice. Can someone give me the time before I overstay my welcome? Anyone know? I wanted to spend about 20 minutes. Still Shabbat, exactly. As long as no one's in it, I don't know, people get hungry. Shabbat is a wonderful thing, but it shouldn't all be spent in the synagogue. It should be spent with one's family and resting and reading. And so I'd like to balance that for you. Because I've been to Shabbat services that are 3.5 hours long, and I think after a while it doesn't feel like Shabbat anymore. So I want to leave you with a few thoughts that are, I can't quite tell you the relation, but I know they're connected. So there is a saying in the Talmud, in one of the first pages of the Talmud, that is ethically or theologically problematic unless you read it differently. So Rava says, if one sees that suffering comes to you, one should investigate one's deeds, which on the surface seems to indicate you did something wrong. That's probably why you're suffering. You just haven't dug enough. Not theology I would ever tolerate or swallow. I think what is a possible reading of it, I've heard a colleague do this, is to say this: suffering is real. I was listening to Otis Rush or some blues musician saying, you know, I don't want to live a life with too much blues, too much pain. And I think that's a foolish way to guide your life because you know, hedonistic choices are poor. You can't avoid suffering. So let's say that the Talmud is saying suffering is going to come to us all. As it says elsewhere, you know, that you offer a mourner lentils because lentils are round. And just like a round thing, it comes around, grief comes around to us all. But what I have seen, and I think we've all noticed this, the great, the wise, the gentle, are those who use moments of trial to grow, to reflect, to dig deeper. And once they do, once they reach a point of acceptance and learning, though they endure pain, it is not suffering. Remember the difference. Pain is an external experience. Suffering is an internal experience. Maybe. But I think the point one could take is yifashfesh b'maasav, examine your deeds. You should do that every day, certainly this week, but on a regular basis. And then there's Maimonides, who brings the concept of tshuva together to wrap that up with the concept of rebuke and mitzvah, the mitzvah of rebuking oneself and rebuking one's fellow. Typically, the mitzvah in Leviticus is written as rebuke your fellow, but our sages from the Hasidic movement onward and probably even before understood that you are not permitted or you are not wise to rebuke a fellow until you have looked into yourself. And psychologists would say the same thing. If you hate something about someone else, it's because you own it too. You know, you can't stand their problem because you do the exact same thing. So there are five things, he says, Maimonides says, that lock up the path of tshuva from one who would commit them, who would do tshuva. If you separate yourself from your community, because then when you do tshuva, you won't be with them and you won't be included in their growth, in their good deeds. If you dispute the words of your sages, because the dispute causes you to separate from them and you won't hear what they have to say, you won't learn their wisdom, you won't see their path of tshuva. If you disparage the mitzvot, I just realized what these are all about. Let me see if I can put them into good words. All of the things he's about to say, whether you disparage the mitzvot, you dishonor the rabbis, you hate reprimand, is you're not listening. You're not listening to yourself. You're not listening to the external voices. You're not allowing the image of yourself that others reflect back at you to penetrate. Whether it's a sage, a rabbi, a friend, someone who offers you a quick word of reprimand and encouragement, or you divorce yourself and become a hermit from the community, you're not going to hear. Whether the words are in the form of a slogan or in the form of a paragraph, whether it's done in the sense of you watch someone doing the action or they beckon you to do the action or they command you to do the action. What Maimonides is enjoining us is to keep our eyes and ears open, to be mindful, to use the Buddhist term, to what's around us. You know, if you're lucky, I love when people tell me what I do wrong because my first thought is, I know. You got any advice how to fix it? Because there's really 99 out of 100 things I hear from other people I knew. It's a treasure when someone tells you something you hadn't, helps you connect and make an epiphany. But often, you know, I don't think I'm the only one who knows every bad thing about myself. I think we each know what we're doing wrong. And the question is, are you going to be open to others' help? Are you going to be open to others' advice and wisdom and to watching the ways other people do it? And frankly, in Maimonides' opinion and in mine, are you going to be open to the wisdom of our tradition? You know, the Machzor, maybe my sermons, if I'm lucky, will teach you something, will give you an insight into where you are. People love the new Machzor that Eddie Feld presented because it has a lot of wonderful supplementary readings in which people see themselves. You know, whether it's a small amount or a large amount, low-hanging fruit, the whole enchilada, whether you're going to make short-term plans or long-term plans, whether you're going to watch the way other people do it or let them tell you what to do, are you open? Are you available to the lessons of this season and frankly beyond?